Hello, and welcome to New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. Progressive people from Afghanistan, Iraq, Jordan, and the United States will start dropping in. They'll be bringing us stories and experiences that are too often missed by mainstream media. Refugees fleeing from the war on terror, women standing up to Afghani warlords, and barriers being built on the information superhighway. I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine, and I'm very excited because today we're joined by Malalai Joya, an outspoken member of the Afghanistan Parliament. Malalai is an extraordinary woman who regularly gets death threats for her efforts. Her political career started at 27 years of age when she gave a short speech to the elected delegates at Lord Jerker, the Grand Council, which was framing the Afghanistan Constitution just over 3 years ago. Tell us what you said, Malalai.
I said about criminals, warlords who controlled Lord Jerker, and that they did lots of crimes and they destroyed our countries and they must face to the national and international courts. And a few minutes speech around this issue, and I wanted to continue, but unfortunately they turned off microphone and they shouted prostitute, infidel, communist, unfortunately men and some women.
You were actually called a prostitute, communist, infidel, and these were by people who were affronted by what you were saying, that effectively the warlords in the Grand Council, the Lawyer Jerker, shouldn't be there. They should be in jail rather than making policy decisions about Afghanistan.
Yeah, at least they must say sorry to our people because they did lots of crimes in Afghanistan. But unfortunately, after the domination of Taliban, by support of US and its allies, once again, these criminals, especially North Alliance, they come in power with the mask of democracy, with suit and tie. And they learn how to talk about democracy, women rights and human rights, and they do not believe in. Even in parliament, every time when I want to talk, they do not let me. Even on 7th of May, they physically beat at me by throwing bottles of water, and they shouted, prostitute, take and rape her. And also they directly
threatened
me to death. Yeah, even some women also, not only men. Even Human Rights Watch also reported that most of members of the parliaments, they are warlords, drug lords and criminals, that they kill lots of freedom-loving Democrat men and women in our country. Jihadis come in power from 92 to 96 and they start civil war in Afghanistan just because of power and because of money, and they were puppet of different countries, neighbor countries and foreign countries. And they also did lots of crimes and they killed lots of innocent people. And then Taliban came in power. But once again, unfortunately, by support of US, those criminals that from 92 to 96, they did crimes, they come in power. That's why now Afghanistan is one of the biggest producers of the opium. Now there is no fundamental changes. Most of violence against women even higher than Taliban period. And lots of problems that our people, they have right now. And they are like hostage in the hands of these criminals.
Yes. I mean, when you're talking about problems associated with women, problems associated with the continuation of the growing of the poppies, what you're saying, I think, is more of the same, that under the Taliban, under the Northern Alliance, these problems were very large problems for your society, and now they're continuing. Afghanistan's political structure has been largely mapped out by people outside your country. It started with an international conference in Bonn, Germany, in 2001. Your president, Hamid Karzai, supports a parliament that includes those groups who you point out have cruelly governed Afghanistan in the past, the Taliban, the Northern Alliance, the Mujahideens. Karzai calls it the Big Tent. Why did he think that this would work, that it would produce a democratic result?
Because on one hand, our government is non-democratic government. U.S. come in Afghanistan just because of their own interests, because of their strategy policies in Afghanistan. They don't think about the suffer people of Afghanistan. And most of these criminals, Nord Alliance, they have very high posts, even some of them are assistants of Karzai. And right now, our people, they hate Karzai as a person who always have compromised with these warlords in the past. And even he promised to our people during the presidential election, I will never have. Until now he has, unfortunately. That's why that our people do not support him just because he is like hostage in the hands of these criminals. Year by year, it was possible for him to make them powerless, to do not have compromise with them, to do not support these fundamentalist warlords. And instead of that, he must support the freedom-loving Democrat people of Afghanistan parties. And also, liberation is not something that donated. No nation can donate liberation to another nation.
Yes.
People, they themselves must do some sacrifices, especially the responsibility of a president of a country like Afghanistan, that after more than 25 years war and suffering violence and crimes, he come in power. But he must do some sacrifices, but unfortunately no. Human Rights Watch published the names of the criminals, about 9% of them who have high posts right now in Afghanistan. It's hopeful, but unfortunately with the mask of democracy and with support of US, they are in power.
So when you've just talked about the US, tell us about the US position at the moment and how they're supporting these particular people in power.
These are the reasons that what we are saying this is a mockery of democracy. Why, for example, there is lots of violence against women. Now Afghanistan is one of the biggest producers of the opium under the control of US, and the people, most of them are poor. 40% of the people are jobless, and large buildings doesn't solve the problem of the people. And you should ask, these buildings belongs to who? To those criminals, those drug lords who receive lots of money under the name of widows, orphans, reconstruction of our countries, but most of money is are going in their own pockets. That's the big problem.
And when you say most of the money, are you meaning aid money that's coming into the country and that should be, for instance, for the 40% of Afghani people who aren't working at the moment?
Karzai only can control Kabul, not out of Kabul. Taliban and other terrorists, they use from this situation and they improve their terrorist activities in Afghanistan. And lots of financial aids international community do, they are going in the pockets of them. And that's why I'm asking from international community, when you help, when you are giving money that we need, please ask them if really they are trusted people. Please try to support freedom-loving Democrat parties in Afghanistan. Even now they cannot publish their magazines because of lack of money. They cannot improve their activities.
For the international community who is giving aid, how developed are your other political structures? As I understand it, the warlords have by far and away the most members in parliament. What other political parties are there that can actually spring up to actually take the place of the warlords at the moment?
They don't have chance. For example, best students from the schools, from the universities, they prefer to work with NGOs just because of receiving money, lots of money. And there is no chance for Democrat, freedom-loving people and parties in Afghanistan, and government do not support them.
Yes.
They need to the help of international community, the Democrat, freedom-loving parties and peoples around the world.
But I'm wondering now, the freedom-loving people of Afghanistan, what do they want to see in a governing body? What do they tell you that they want?
Yeah, the most important things that they need is security. You know, when we do not have security, how we can talk about democracy? How we can talk about women rights, human rights in our country? On the other hand, they need women rights. Half of the population of a country, they do not have education. They do not play their role. How the country can improve? It's like a bird. When one wing of the bird will be injured, how it can fly? They don't want women get education because they know when half of the population, they become aware, they cannot do that much violence that right now they do in Afghanistan. If we improve the knowledge of the men and women in Afghanistan, we will rebuild our country very soon and they will play their role. But the problem is this, that on one hand, their knowledge is law, and the enemies they use from this, and especially they use Islam and jihad against our people, because most of people of Afghanistan, they did jihad. These criminals, they are saying in Islam, saying women must not go to schools. But I want to say you, even in Islam, we had some Muslim woman many, many years before, like Bibi Aisha. She was teacher.
One of the things that strikes me so much about you is your voice. It's a very strong voice. And you were out of the country, out of Afghanistan. You fled with your family when you were 4 years old. You didn't come back until you were a young adult. Where did you find your strong voice?
From my people. You know, when I was in 8th class high school in refugee camps in Pakistan, I started to be a social activist because I was the oldest daughter of my family and we had economic problems like other Afghans that they lived there. I started working there and I became teacher of literacy courses for women and girls there.
In the refugee camps?
In refugee camps. I worked with different committees there. Then in 1998 and 1999, I started working with the OPAC, Organization of Promoting Afghan Women's Capabilities.
So that was when you returned to Afghanistan from Pakistan.
Yeah, and when that was the time in 98 when I finished 12th class, and I thought it's better that now at least I get education a little bit. I wanted to, as a social activist, to do something for them, especially under the domination of Taliban. There was no education for them. And after the domination of Taliban, when I went to my own province, which is Farah, close to Herat, there also I was social activist on behalf of OPAC. We had different activities and with lots of problems, but because I had close communication with people, that's why they voted me when I was candidate. And after that, my life completely changed. Until now, I learned a lot from non-educated people, from suffer people, men and women of Afghanistan, and I found this courage, this strength from the ruin of my country, that even if they could speak, they also will stand up against these criminals who destroyed our countries. You know, our Kabul one day was very beautiful. People around the world, as tourists, they come there and just to see our Kabul, but now it's completely like ruined. Every house, they lost their sons, they lost their families, they raped their old mothers, even 60-year-old mother. They did lots of violence against men and women in Afghanistan that, in my opinion, no pen, no book, no person will be able to write about the suffering of people of Afghanistan that much that they saw in their lives. Mm. I learned from my people.
Mm. In terms of getting your voice, you are now sharing that knowledge with other women. You are actually encouraging other women to speak. And you were saying that you got your education outside of the country, in Pakistan. You went to year 12 and you shared that knowledge with people in refugee camps. What are you doing for the women of Afghanistan to give them a voice? Because they have been encouraged, haven't they, to only exercise their voice within their own homes, not outside their homes. You don't agree with that? How can you encourage other women in Afghanistan to have the confidence to step out and speak?
Yeah, in my opinion, in this situation, I want to say that I'm not alone and I'm not the first person that I stand up against them, and I'm sure that I will not be the last person because this country have lots of Malawi. They have more courage even than me. They are better than me. Nobody know about them. But now I'm happy that this voice become voice of them. The most important things that as a social activist that I have communication with them and contact with them, the most important things that they want and they need is education. It's the most important things for them. When they become aware, they can struggle because of their rights very well. And nobody can do that much crimes that they do right now against our women. They cannot. And they are like silence line, in my opinion, women in our country. And if they have chance, they will play their role more better than some men.
Let's go now to the Middle East to chat with Kathy Breen in Amman, Jordan. Kathy's working with Iraqi refugees in Jordan at the moment, refugees that the rest of the world won't take. How many Iraqis are there in Jordan at the moment, Kathy?
United Nations estimates put the number at 700,000 to up to a million or more.
And how does that compare with the amount of Iraqi refugees being taken by other countries?
This is exactly one of the questions I think that we have to address. Last year, a trusted Iraqi friend from Baghdad was here in Amman for about a month, and he said to us, if you want to do something concrete to help Iraqis, find out what countries will take us. There are so many rumors, you know, inside Iraq and here in Amman as to where we can go. So we actually did just that. We began a preliminary survey and contacted over 30 embassies and consulates here in Jordan. There are about 59 here in Jordan, to ask specifically what their immigration/asylum policies were for Iraqis. And the findings were very dismal. I could say that Australia is the most favorable country toward Iraqis with respect to immigration. And they had a quota of over 2,000 a year, but this has been reduced now. This year, Australia will be taking 1,000. We understand Canada will be taking 1,000. The United States, from where I come, will be taking, we say, the Bush administration, 7,000 this year. That's questionable, given the arduous security requirements that total will be achieved by the end of the year. So from there, it's all downhill. Jordan and Syria are the two main hosting countries for Iraqi refugees. Jordan has a phenomenal record of giving people shelter, but they're not recognized here as refugees. Jordan and Syria, while very generous in accepting Iraqis, they're not signers to the 1951 Refugee Convention, and so resettlement or local integration is not a possibility here. So the vast majority do not have legal residency, cannot work, and are subject to deportation if they're picked found working or if they've overstayed their visa here. And they're stuck here.
Yes.
I think that's a good image. They're stuck. They've come here fleeing violence, hoping to move on, thinking that there are refugee resettlement countries open to them, and in fact, there are not.
I'm just thinking of those figures that you've just given us, 7,000 in the United States, 1,000 in Australia, 1,000 in Canada. It is a pimple on the face of the earth compared
to
the...
Yes, and might I say, I'm going to interrupt you because I think what is really appalling with respect to the United States, who caused this problem, this crisis, and the UK, who accepted a pittance last year. The United States, I think we accepted 466, something around that figure, since 2003. And this is just almost unspeakable. And I think now the effort on the parts of the Bush administration is to make good or to try to remedy this poor image. But Jordan itself has a population of, let's say, 5.5 million people. So if you add a million or 700,000 to that, you could say one in six people in Jordan are Iraqis now, which creates a tremendous stress on the already fragile infrastructure in Jordan.
Absolutely. I mean, how is Jordan coping with such a huge increase in its population?
Well, one way is by trying not to recognize them as refugees, wanting to see them as temporarily here. And this has created a great problem for Jordan. Their unemployment reaches 15%, and there is a great water shortage here in the country, and unemployment, increasing fuel prices. So it's already a poor country to begin with. So this creates a great burden for Jordan. This is changing, though, however. And I think we can say pretty accurately that for the most part, the borders of both Jordan and Syria are closed to almost all Iraqis now, which is something that's quite tragic in itself when you think that 50,000 Iraqis a month are trying to escape the violence and really are not able to get out now of their country. So within Iraq, there are at least 2 million displaced, internally displaced Iraqis who have left their homes, their jobs, their security.
Yes. The hypocrisy of it is amazing. Sending troops in to change regime and leaving the people there to die. It's just extraordinary stuff. I'm wondering, what conditions are Iraqi refugees in Jordan facing at the moment? What are their living conditions?
Yeah, I think that's a good question because we have to understand their situation. What you have here are urban refugees, let's call that, let's say, and people not living in tents. People who are having to, even though we would recognize them as refugees, they don't have legal refugee status. They're not seen as refugees, but as visitors. They have to pay rent. So they're paying. They have to pay for medical services, for food, for everything. So, and the great fear of deportation, I must say, lingers over them. So there's also a restricted freedom of movement.
Yes, I understand that the Iraqis in Jordan have just been landed with a passport problem. What's that about, Kathy?
Yes, this is almost impossible to articulate, and I would like to describe this. I believe it was in January, the UK was the first country to announce that it would only recognize Iraqis who had G, a new series, G, as in George, passports. And these are new passports. They're electronically coded. And they are only procured in Baghdad. So then everybody started following suit, the U.S. and other countries. And I believe as of June 1st, the Jordanian government will only recognize G passports. So I want to say that last year in Iraq, almost 2 million S passports were issued. But very soon, all passports other than the G series will be invalid.
And what's the consequence of that?
Well, that means that no one could come into Jordan, either from Iraq or elsewhere, without a G passport. I can tell you that there are people, Iraqis here in Amman, who have been waiting for months, who have a visa, actually, at the U.S. Embassy, ready for them to go to travel to family in the U.S. And they've been waiting for years. And they have their visa now, but they have no G passport. And they're being asked to go back into Baghdad to get the passport. This is like sending someone back into a burning building, into a life-threatening situation from which they've just fled in order to be able to move on. I know of a young family, the young man was just about to start his master's program in Baghdad, and his father was kidnapped and tortured and was eventually released. But when a second attempt was made on his father's life, the family fled to Amman. And he just got a scholarship to the UK to begin a master's program there. And you can imagine the joy of the family. Well, lo and behold, he lost the scholarship because he doesn't have a G passport and wasn't able to return to Baghdad to get one. So this is just a very hard, painful reality that's being added on top of the long, long suffering facing Iraqis right now. I don't think I've ever been in a country where, or among a people where education is so highly valued as in Iraq. So if you can imagine the pain that not being able to put your children in school here, the pain that that represents for Iraqis is quite great. And if indeed there are 1 million Iraqis here, and that could be an underestimation, if all of a sudden they could put their children in school here, then Jordan would have to absorb, it could be up to 250,000 children in their school system.
Yes.
This is an impossibility for Jordan.
Yes, they just haven't got the infrastructure at the moment, have they?
That's
Kathy,
right.
Kathy, let me bring Malali Joya, the youngest member of the Afghanistan Parliament, into this conversation. Malali,
yes.
Have Afghani people who fled when the United States attacked your country after September 11 in 2001 met fates similar to the one that Kathy's just been describing?
Yes, of course. Afghanistan and Iraq, they have the same problem.
So tell us about how many people, Afghani people, have fled the country now and where are they?
Yeah, most of them, they are not able to go to foreign countries because of economic situation problems that they have. But most of them are going in the refugee countries like Iran, like Pakistan. They are living in very bad condition of life and they are working very hard, but they receive very less money. Even some young generation, they lost their life. Even inside Afghanistan, some refugees, when they return back in Afghanistan with lots of hopes, they are living under the tents. For example, in the winter, right now, under the tent, some of them, because of cold, has died.
The Afghani people who fled are coming back into the country now. Is that what the parliament is encouraging people to do?
Most of them, as you know, majority seats of the parliament has been taken by different types of the warlords, the drug lords, and these criminals. For example, now 68 members of the parliament, they are women, more than some European countries. Most of them, they want to deceive people around the world. They are not real representatives because these warlords, they did campaign for them. Because from that kind of non-democratic parliament, how we should be hopeful that they will do something? For example, now they are discussing about their own salary, about their own benefits. Most of them, they are thinking about their benefits on the side of the parliaments, about the benefits of their parties, bloody parties. They don't think about the people of Afghanistan inside of parliament.
Bringing Cathy Brin back into the conversation now. Yes. Cathy, are you seeing there some parallels between Afghanistan and Iraq? Malalai Joya has just been describing what the parliamentary reaction has been like to Afghani people coming home. Are you seeing a similar reaction with...
No, I think it's something has certainly shifted in the last 2 years in the increase in violence that Iraq is being subjected to, that it's no longer possible to ask people to go back into Iraq. For instance, the passport situation, the UNHCR would not see that as an option either, that someone go back to Baghdad to get a passport. So, no, there is not a question in my own mind or... any rational person's mind that it's an option to go back into Iraq. To the contrary, thousands of people are trying to get out and they can't.
Yes.
They're trying to flee. So I think we have to look at Iraq as a prison that people can't get out. And once they're out, if indeed they were to be able to get out, where would they go?
I'm wondering what the Iraqi government is doing, how it is responding to the pressure of the refugees that are in other countries and indeed who are trying to get out of Iraq at the moment.
I think it's a situation of extremity, obviously, and the only way to address the situation is a comprehensive political solution. You know, the stakes couldn't be higher. It couldn't be clearer that a military solution is not the answer and that the presence of U.S. troops is a catalyst for violence. But the solution is going to be a political solution within Iraq.
To stop the violence.
Yes.
Cathy, thank you so much for joining us. It's such an early hour in your part of the world.
You're very welcome.
That was Cathy Brin, who's working with Iraqi refugees in Amman, Jordan. Radio New Internationalist, and I'm Chris Richards, sitting in Radio 3CR studios in Australia with Malalai Joya, the youngest member of the Afghanistan Parliament. I'd like to talk now about a number of issues that we've just touched on briefly today, but need further explanation. How active politically are young people in Afghanistan at the moment, Malalai?
Yeah, you know that now only young generation in Afghanistan, even children of Afghanistan, they do politics. Like Palestine, they use some kind of stones that they threw to their troops. In Afghanistan is same. Young generation, like 20 and more than 20, they are war generation in Afghanistan. And every young generation in Afghanistan, they want to do politics and they know about politics. They have energy and they want to do something for their country inside of Afghanistan and outside of Afghanistan. But unfortunately, there is no chance for them. And they don't want to give them chance. They are in power because they know that these young generations don't want to have compromise with them because they learned from their past, who destroyed their country. They learned a lot from their history. But as a young generation, I try my best to be united with them, to work with them together, because we have big responsibility about our countries. I told them one day, they will kill me as a person. You are the ones, you continue. They cannot hide the truth. They cannot make silence the voice of the people.
Indeed. Joya, we've just touched on the fact that your voice is strong and it's brave, but you must be coming up against very many powerful people. What is your personal security like?
Yeah, they cannot tolerate me because they know that I never have compromised with them. And several times I said, as a person, physically, maybe one day you kill me, but you cannot make silence this voice. Sometimes they are writing on the walls against me propaganda, and even inside of the parliament, they are telling me take and rape her, prostitute, and like that. Even once in parliament, the MP that stand up next to the door of the parliament, when they beat at me by throwing bottles of water, when I said we have in Afghanistan two kind of mujahideen, real mujahideen and criminal mujahideen. And he said to his person that to stand up next to the door of the parliament when she is going outside, beat her with knife a few times. After that, she will know who are mujahideen. And also through different ways, I received threats to this. For example, in parliament, nowadays they are making a bill. The criminals want to forgive themselves. And UN even announced position against that bill, and they said this is the right of the victims. Some other MPs, we stand up against this bill, Democrat MPs, and they torture me to death, and they are saying we made silence her, we kill her. I have to go with bodyguards outside of the house with guns, that I stand up against gun and gun laws. But unfortunately, just because I'm young and I want to do something for my people and I have lots of energy, I have to use gun with my life.
You carry a gun.
And I'm changing the houses because four times they did assassination against me, and the last time they attacked my house an office in Kabul. Now, when I'm going from here, I can't go directly to Kabul because of security reasons.
I'm wondering, do you have children yourself?
No, this is 1 year that I got married. Even I can't be with my husband, with my family because of security reasons. And now I have lots of responsibility, and it's difficult to have children and make family right now, but maybe in the future.
And your husband is safe?
He cannot be with me. It's risky for him also, and I don't want to. And even my family, and this is risky for them also. But I'm happy that they support me. I don't want to let them easy to kill me, because I'm proud that now this voice of woman who nobody listened to their voice. This is the voice of the Sanawar who has been raped and exchanged with a dog. This is the voice of Nadia Anjuman, who was the great poet of our country, who has been killed by her husband. And this is the voice of women and men in Afghanistan who do not have liberation at all. Why I'm telling about these? Because I want to tell you that those people who are telling the truth, who do struggle against them, they have lots of problems, especially I'm a woman. On one hand, I expose them, and another hand, because they are against women, I'm a woman, and I do struggle against them. Even I'm not sure from here when I'm going, how many more days I will be alive. But I trust my people. I know that one day they will kill me, but they cannot hide the truth.
There are so many challenges facing the Afghanistan parliament at the moment. One of them is a subject we've touched on, poppy farming. On the one hand, the farmers need the money from the heroin poppy crops. But on the other hand, the US in particular wants to get rid of them all. What is the Afghanistan parliament thinking about that issue?
Yeah, as I said earlier, most of members of the parliament, they are not good people. Some of them are drug lords. One assistant of the head of the parliament is a drug lord man. The head of the parliament is also one of the criminal men who belongs to Northern Alliance Party. Some of these criminals, they are MPs, some of them are ministers. They control Afghanistan, and our people like hostage in the hands of them, unfortunately. And that's why now Afghanistan become biggest producer of the opium. And now the person who is head of the anti-poppy in Afghanistan, he's himself a drug lord man. Is it possible to stop planting of opium?
Yes. It's one of the main issues that the warlords and the US don't think the same level on.
U.S. spend lots of money on these criminals, on their puppets, and they don't want to lose them. They understood that they did lots of crimes in Afghanistan, and now once again they come in power by support of them. This is clear example that they think about their own strategy in Afghanistan. Nowadays they are talking they want to give more chance for Gulbuddin Party and also Taliban. If more people like them come in power, Once again, the circle of the warlordism, drug lordism, and terrorism will be complete. And once again, the victims will be the suffering innocent people of Afghanistan. Mm. And as most of the victims during the war was women, until now lots of violence, and once again will be women.
Yes, we had Alia from Rawa in our first program explaining some of the horrendous crimes that are being inflicted on women at the moment and their reaction, that they are burning themselves alive. I'm wondering, because of time, we might move past the women's issue, which is extremely important in Afghanistan, into our next topic. Our next guest is going to be talking about the internet. And education is such an important issue, as you described it, in Afghanistan. I'm wondering how many people in Afghanistan have access to the information superhighway, the internet, computers, things like that.
Yeah, I want to tell you that OPAC right now, Organization of Promoting Afghan Women's Capabilities, we have lots of problem with money because the government do not support us in the young generation of Afghanistan. They also want to have internet facilities, internet knowledge, and we try to improve our activities. And the only hope is the international community, freedom-loving, democrat people around the world to help us, for example, to improve our activities.
You're a member of parliament. Do you have a laptop?
No, I do not have laptop. Unfortunately, I received second-hand laptops through supporters around the world. But, you know, it doesn't work well. And, for example, 1 week before I came here, another laptop also stopped working and lots of problem. But I don't want to say personally about myself. Even I'm a social activist, I'm facing with lots of problems. So you should think about other generation to build for them schools, literacy courses, hospitals. You know, I can't because the government also do not support me. And for example, lots of project I have there that till now I didn't become able at least to make a school for them.
What is the literacy rate at the moment in Afghanistan?
Yeah, most of them, they do not have education. Those Afghans that they become refugees in the West countries and also in neighbor countries, there was some facilities for them to get education. But most of them, you know, they lived during the war in Afghanistan. Till now they are living, they do not have education in Afghanistan, and they need.
And so how many people are outside of Afghanistan who are coming back into Afghanistan at the moment?
It's very difficult to tell you because right now even most of them, they want to leave Afghanistan, and some of them, they are going to neighbor countries, or the
Pakistan,
only place that they can go,
Iran.
Yeah, because they have economic problems. And those who returned, they have very bad condition of life. And the percentages are difficult to tell you because they are going and coming. And those who are coming, they are saying why they come, because there is even not human life for them.
As you were describing about the tents in the snow, I'm just wondering if people are listening and they want to assist in terms of education or in terms of health issues or women's issues, how can they? Where do they go to actually offer financial assistance or other kinds of assistance?
If you want to help OPAC, you can find through OPAC website and also through my website.
OPAC is the organization.
Yeah, this is a non-governmental organization like NGO that we have health and education activities in different parts of Afghanistan. I was director in west of Afghanistan in Farah, Herat and Nimruz. OPAC believes that because women and children, they were the most and first victims during the war. Until now, there's lots of violence against them. That's why that our activities focus on women, and we have health and education activities for them.
Excellent. So if people would like to go to the OPAC website, it's opawc.malalijoya, MALALAIJOYA.com. Another alternative for this website is www.geocities, geocities.com/OPAWC, OPAWC. Malalijoya, it was a privilege to meet you. We'd love you to join us again for a chat once you're back in Afghanistan. Travel well and safely and keep your voice strong.
Thank you. Once again, please do not forget the forgotten and suffer people of Afghanistan, especially women.
With people like you, how could we? Thank you very much, Malalijoya. That was the youngest member of Afghanistan's parliament, Malalijoya. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist, being broadcast on radio stations around the world, like the one you're listening to now. I'm Chris Richards, and we've just been talking with Mulali Joya, a very brave young woman who's confronting the warlords in Afghanistan's parliament. If you tuned in late and want to hear that interview, just go to the New Internationalist website tomorrow and you'll find it there. If you want to find out more about Joya and her work, or give her support in any way, why don't you visit her Defence Committee's website? It's www.malalajoya.com. Joya's just been telling us how few people have internet connection in Afghanistan and the impact that that has on Afghani lives. Julian Payne has just called in from Paris. He heads up the Internet Freedom Desk at Reporters Sans Frontières, Reporters Without Borders. I understand that the problem for freedom of speech in Afghanistan threatens journalists more than internet bloggers at the moment. Is that right, Julian?
Yes, the problem in Afghanistan in terms of internet is more a problem of infrastructure, which is very bad. The connectivity for internet users is not good. They don't have access to broadband, for example. But we don't have much problem in terms of internet users' rights. No blogger harassed or online journalist jailed, no whatsoever. It's the situation is okay. But Afghanistan is a very dangerous place for journalists and especially reporters who try to go to the tribal areas. And we had recently an Italian journalist named Daniele Mastro Giacomo who got kidnapped by the Taliban and he's still detained by the Taliban. Most of our work at the moment is to try to campaign to get this Republica journalist released by the Taliban.
It's just one of a number of your campaign targets at the moment. I see that a blogger in Egypt has just been in prison for 4 years for inciting hatred of Islam over the internet. What did he say in his blogs that was so offensive, Julian?
Actually, his sentence has just been upheld in appeal days ago. So he will spend 4 years in prison, that's for sure now. And what did he do? I mean, basically nothing that would be condemned in France or in a democratic country. He just criticized the government online, and especially the President Mubarak. And he also, they said that he insulted Islam. He just said that he disapproved Islam brutality. Well, he was quite harsh on Islamists, of course, but nothing that would be deemed unacceptable in Europe or in a democratic country. And just for that, he got sentenced to 4 years in prison. Mm. What does it mean? Mm. It simply means that the Egyptian authorities are scared by the internet and by the information which is circulated online. And they want to put limits to the bloggers because they know that they're the ones who are circulating independent information and they're the ones who are dangerous for their authority.
Mm. I mean, they wouldn't be the only ones, would they? To date this year, 133 journalists have been thrown in jail because of what they've said in their reports, compared to 60 cyber dissidents. The significant thing here is that as an international trend, jailing ordinary people who are blogging over the internet is rising. When you and I last talked 3 years ago, internet enemies, governments and countries that restrict internet debate and attack their critics with imprisonment were pretty rare. What's the position now?
Well, as you said, it's a phenomenon which is clearly spreading. Like 4 or 5 years ago, very few countries censored the internet. And you had China, of course, which were already very efficient at controlling the internet.
Yes. But
it had a few followers, but not so many. And when you look at the world now, so many countries are now censoring the internet and jailing people for what they publish online. I'll just give you an example which is striking. Even Ethiopia now is censoring online publications and especially blogs. So even in sub-Saharan African countries, dictators and authoritarian regime try to take their grip on the internet. And I think that's a clear trend. It's not the end. And we'll see that in the near future, the situation will even get worse. Because, of course, these authoritarian regime have realized that they cannot just control the traditional medias, TV, radio, and newspapers, and let people have free access to the internet, because that wouldn't make sense, because internet users would get the information they want on the internet.
How do these governments find out what people are actually saying? Do they just have people monitoring blogs all day?
Well, it depends on the country. In China, for example, it's a mix of human resources, meaning people actually moderating forums and spying on internet communications, and new technologies and new ways of censoring and intercepting communications. So you need first to hire, of course, a cyber police, and China, of course, has a huge cyber police, but they also have very efficient technological tools to suppress freedom of expression. Usually these tools have been first acquired from American companies.
I mean, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? I noticed that you're also running a campaign at the moment to discourage web service providers from going along with governments who want to restrict their people's ability to research or debate issues of national interest, like in China. Issues like, isn't it about time we had an election? Tell us who you're targeting in this campaign and why.
Well, the bottom line is we believe that private companies should be concerned by freedom of expression. That it's not only a concern for diplomats and regular citizens. When you're a company and you're doing business in a very repressive regime, you cannot turn a blind eye on what's happening in terms of human rights. You have to be conscious. You have to know what's going on and take your decisions according to also moral principles. That's the message we're trying to convey. And when you look at what's happening in China, you see that these internet companies don't respect human rights, don't respect freedom of expression, and when you try to ask them why, and if they don't feel responsible, they're always telling you that it's none of their business because there are private companies and then, of course, business-driven. So, I mean, the main targets of our campaigns are, first of all, Yahoo, because we found out that Yahoo helped to jail people we defend, journalists. What did they do? And basically, the police came to them and say, well, we have this email address. We know it's this email address sent subversive material on the internet. We want you to tell us who's behind this email address. And actually, Yahoo has been doing that for more than 4 years. They've been collaborating with the police, and they've been handing over information about their customers every time the Chinese police asked for it.
And some of those people would have been imprisoned.
Yeah, and actually, we know for sure that four people that are on our list, four journalists, are currently in jail thanks to information provided by Yahoo. It was written in their verdict. Can you imagine that? Oh. If you read the verdict of these people, you can see that thanks to Yahoo, they've been, you know, charged and sentenced to jail.
So when you talk to Yahoo about this, what do they say?
When we are confronting them with that, you know, problem, ethical problem, they're always answering the same thing, which is, we're not doing anything illegal, because in China, what we're doing is legal. So we don't see why you're, like, bashing us like that, because we're just private companies, we don't have to fight for freedom of expression, and we're not doing anything illegal. So what we're telling them is, well, maybe you're not doing anything illegal in China, but you have to stand for some basic moral principles. Because what if, for example, China would ask you to have children working in your offices, like 6-year-old children, you know, delivering mail to your employees? Would you tell us, like, well, it's legal in China, so I will do it? Of course not. You will stand to your principle and say, I won't agree to do that because I'm an American company and I believe in certain values.
But
so why is it so different when you're talking about freedom of expression? It's a human right, isn't it?
Absolutely. But what do you do when they say, go away, we don't want to know?
We are trying to find ways to put pressure upon this company. It's difficult, of course, because they are very powerful companies. But first of all, we asked legislators in the U.S. to introduce a law that would prevent these companies from doing that. And this law will be discussed at the Congress this year. We don't know if it's going to pass, but at least there's pressure from this side. And we also asked the investors of these companies, huge investment fund, to take a position and to say whether or not they believe that, as owners of these companies, they believe that the behavior of these companies was acceptable or not. And surprisingly, most investors agreed with us and supported us.
That's institutional investors, is it? Institutional investors are prepared to go to Yahoo and say, look, you can't do this anymore.
Yes, they are. Actually, a major investor, which is called the New York City Comptroller, which is actually a pension fund of the city of New York accepted to file a shareholder resolution at the next Yahoo Assembly, which means that at the next General Assembly, there will be a question from this huge investor, and their resolution will be voted by any shareholder of Yahoo. And this resolution says, well, you have to stop what you're doing in China and find acceptable ways of dealing with that country.
Of course, Yahoo wouldn't be on their own there. China is such a lucrative market. I can imagine that service providers, internet and email, are being placed in pressure situations by the Chinese government to toe the line.
Of course, Yahoo is not the only one. There's such a harsh competition going on between these internet giants. And we can also talk about Google, for example, and Microsoft, which are more or less doing the same as Yahoo. Yeah, I would say that Yahoo is the worst because they're starting doing it earlier, since 2002. Mm. But most of the internet giants, they want to get a piece of the cake. They want to get into China, even though they feel uncomfortable with the Chinese demands. They feel that they have to make some agreement with them. So, for example, Google, which was totally uncensored until recently, accepted in 2005 to censor its search engine. So now if you're making a search using the google.cn, the Chinese version, you won't get any information coming from the so-called subversive websites.
Mm. Increasingly, we're living more in an economy and less in a society. Can you see a time where commercial users will get preference on the internet, Julien?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think a problem now is that huge companies are trying to set up a different kind of internet. The internet has been created so that wherever you are and whatever your website is, you have access to the same infrastructure. And no company is able to tell you that you will be using a slow internet and that another, you know, more important website will be using faster internet. So far, it's not possible because that's not the way the internet has been designed.
Mm.
But that may change in the future because, for example, in the US, there's a huge debate about net neutrality because telecom operators like Verizon or others are trying to pass legislation which would allow them to create these two-speed internet, which means that if you have money and you're a big website, you'll be able to pay for a huge broadband. But if you're a small blog or a human rights organization, you will be put on a slow internet. And that's totally unacceptable because if it happens even in the US, can you imagine what effect that would have in China?
Mm.
They could decide that all small blogs and human rights organizations are on a very, very bad internet infrastructure. And that would be the end of the net, how we have it now.
Julien, your work is very interesting at the moment. If people want to read more about it, where should they go?
Two websites I would advise. The first one is, of course, they can go to our website, which is www.rsfreportersansfrontieres.org. But you can also go to another website, which is called rsfblog.org. And this website is very interesting for people who want to set up their own blog, because we offer a tool to these people, and they can set up their blog through RSF. And I think it's important because, of course, to do that, they will have to pay a small fee to create their blog with us. But the thing is, the money you give us is money we'll spend on helping bloggers and people harassed for their online activity. So it's a way to show your solidarity for what's going on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Come to RSF blog, create your blog with us, and you'll be, fighting for freedom.
Enchanté, Julien. Au revoir.
Thank you.
And we will talk again soon.
Thank you. That was a very nice interview.
Bye-bye. That was Julien Payne from the Internet Freedom Desk at Reporters Without Borders in Paris. that's it for today's Radio New Internationalist. Time to say a big thank you to co-producer Rachel Maher. Thanks heaps, Rachel. Join us same time, same place on the dial next week when campaigners from Colombia, Liberia and Sri Lanka are planning to drop in for a chat. The music that we've been playing tonight comes, as usual, from the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. Today's feature album is Introducing Etran Finitoa from Niger, which is a country which serves as a crossroads between the Arabs of North Africa and the sub-Saharan traditions. You can tell in this music. You'll find this CD and many more on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. You'll also find copies of this program on the New Internationalist website, just waiting to be downloaded onto a computer or iPod near you. That's www.newint.org. I'm Chris Richards. Let's talk again next week.